Chapter 4. It seemed clear to Al Miller that soon he would have to give up his lot. He would be preempted for some grand purpose. The new owner would tear down the garage and put up a supermarket or a furniture mart or multiple unit apartments. Such had been the pattern for several years in Oakland and Berkeley. Old buildings were being torn down, even old churches. And if old churches had to go, then surely Ferguson's garage could be thrown in, and Al's motor sales. With no spirit, he drove the next afternoon down San Pablo to a realtor's office, to a woman he had dealt with in the past. It was no accident that Mrs. Lane was a Negro. He had met her through the Doolittles. She had gotten Mrs. Doolittle several of her rental properties. Her specialty was business property, in the non-restricted, he added in his mind, run-down part of Oakland. He knew that he could hope for nothing better. What was a used car lot, if not the embodiment of non-restricted Oakland? Thinking that, he entered Lane Realty and approached the varnished oak counter. To his right on a table was a rubber plant in a pot with a saffron bow tied around it. Beside the plant was a stack of Saturday evening posts and an ashtray. All that Lane Realty had in the way of fixtures were a desk and a typewriter and, on the wall, a map of the East Bay. Mrs. Lane sat at the desk typing, but when she noticed him, she rose and came toward the counter, smiling. "Good morning, Mr. Miller," she said.
"Morning,"
he said. "Now, what can I do for you?" Mrs. Lane had a low, smooth voice. She wore a dark dress, and on her finger she had a nice big gold ring. Her hair had been done up, and she had on lots of makeup. As always, she looked impressive. She was, he thought, about 45 or 50. She could have been a successful matronly receptionist or club woman anywhere, he thought. Except, of course, that she was colored. And except for the fact, too, that when she smiled, she made visible gold-cap front teeth of great size. Jewelry, like her ring, the left of which showed the carving of a diamond, the right a club. Al said,
"I'm looking for a new location."
"I see," Mrs. Lane said. "On San Pablo? I have a lot on Telegraph Avenue." She looked at him searchingly to see what it was he wanted.
I don't care where it is," Al said, "just so it's a good location."
He could think of no way to improve on that utterance. He culled his brain, but no more expressive statement came. The woman smiled at him with sympathy. Beyond any doubt, she wanted to help him. It was her job to do so, and her heart was in her work. He felt that.
"I guess you don't want to go too high," Mrs. Lane said, "as far as rental costs."
"Nope," he agreed. "I could drive you around to that location on Telegraph," Mrs. Lane said.
"You could take a look at it." "I don't need it right away," he said. "I have around 2 months. There's no rush. I want to be sure I get something good."
"Yes, that's the important thing," Mrs. Lane said.
"The used car business doesn't pay very good," he said.
"Must be like the real estate business," Mrs. Lane said with a smile. "Maybe so," Al thought. "We're both in the same boat. Or maybe I'm doing you an injustice, putting you with me, placing you down at such a hopeless point. A personable woman like you? What would you be if you had been born white? Country chairman of the Republican Party? Wife of some industrialist? And what would I be if I had been born colored? Just a jerk. Another nowhere jerk."
"Mr. Miller,"
Mrs. Lane said in her smooth, deep voice, "you really look sad today."
"I am," he said, agreeing to that. "Don't look so sad," she said. "Look on the bright side."
She went back to her desk and got from the drawer a set of car keys.
"Why don't I drive you over to the location I made mention of? I'd be glad to show it to you."
"Maybe later," he said.
"Why not now?" I don't know, he said, hearing himself mumble. I have to get back to the lot.
You might miss out on the opportunity, she said.
Maybe so, he said, feeling dulled and weighed down.
Listen, Mr. Miller, she said softly, leaning her bare, round, brown arms on the counter. You gotta act or you miss out.
I know that one thing I learned from my years in real estate. If you want to get somewhere, you have to take advantage of the situation and move. Do you know that?
She waited, but he said nothing. He gazed down at the floor, feeling his mind too empty for any answer.
You have to do or you be done. I mean, they do you. It's not wrong to be a live wire.
Her voice had a warm, gentle patience, almost a lecturing quality, a mother lecturing quality.
You not going to hurt anybody. I think that what bother you. You afraid you do something wrong to somebody because you in a business where everybody say that anyhow.
He nodded. Mrs. Lane said,
I talked to you before, and I remarked to myself and Mr. Jones, who helped me here, you're a good person to work with, Mr.
What's his name?
Mr. Ferguson. He completely honest, too.
I take my car to him.
Her voice trailed off.
Well, I have my own mechanic.
To himself, Al thought, a Negro mechanic. She wouldn't dare take her car to Jim Ferguson, honest as he is, because he probably wouldn't work on her car. Maybe he would, maybe he wouldn't, but she can't take the chance. It isn't worth it.
Can I show you that location?
Mrs. Lane said, holding up her car keys.
No, he said, some other time. Thanks.
As he left the real estate office, he saw that she was watching him go. She watched him until the side of the building cut off his sight of her and hers of him. Going back, he said, speaking across the threshold.
Maybe in another couple of days, when my plans are more gelled.
Mrs. Lane smiled at him.
With compassion, he thought. Compassion and understanding.
He went on then, back to his car. He thought, she just wants to sell me something. But he knew it was more than that.
Not that at all, actually. What was it then? Love, he thought. Love for him.
Big, middle-aged, good-looking, light-skinned Negro businesswoman, he thought. Wants to mother me, if possible.
He felt depressed. And yet, at the same time, it seemed to him as if some of his burden had departed.
He did not feel as bad as before. That's a smart woman. Smart saleswoman, she knows her stuff, he thought. A real professional. I'll be back. She knows that.
That peasant-minded, shrewd, cretin-brained, old asshole Ferguson has put me here, he thought, where I have to rely on this, on some woman feeling sorry for me, where I have nothing else to get by on. I have no other way to survive, no system of my own. I have to appeal to the soft side of some woman real estate broker. What I ought to do, he thought, is ruin his sale. Screw up his sale forever. I ought to open a whorehouse on the lot and bring disgrace on that location. I ought to turn it into a...
What? That a used car lot isn't already.
Who looks down on me? He asked himself. Everyone? Each person?
He did not feel like going back to his lot. He started up his car, driving in no particular direction. He merely drove through the downtown Oakland traffic, enjoying the feel of the car. It was a good, solid old Chrysler with leather seats. The shift would not go into reverse, however, and so he had acquired it for $75. But still, it was a good car, good enough for any reasonable person. A fine highway car. As he drove along, he conjured up inside his mind a sales presentation which would move this particular item. He dwelt on that to keep himself occupied. When he got back to Al's motor sales, he saw that the big white door of the garage was shut. The old man had closed up the garage, but not for lunch, since the Pontiac was gone. The old-fashioned cardboard sign on the doors had the hands turned so that it all read, "Will return at 2:30." As he parked amid the cars on the lot, he saw that a second car, a nearly new Cadillac, had followed him and was parking behind him, next to his Chevrolet. He got out, and so did the driver of the cad. "Hello," the man called. Al shut the door of his car and walked toward the man. The man, in his early 50s, had on a smartly tailored business suit. Tie, the narrow, fashionable type of tie, and the pointed Italian style of shoes that Al saw in the ads and uptown store windows. The man smiled at him. He had a reasonably friendly manner. His hair was curly, gray, and although somewhat long, was strikingly cut. Al felt a little awed.
"Hi," Al said. "How are you today?"
It was his standard greeting. On his lot, there surely was nothing to interest this well-dressed and obviously well-to-do man who drove last year's Cadillac. For an instant, Al felt uneasy. Perhaps this was a tax agent from the state or even from the federal government. A host of ideas flew through his brain as he faced the man, keeping a smile of greeting on his face. And then he recognized the man. This was one of Ferguson's old customers. Obviously, the man had brought his car around to the garage for work and found the garage shut. "I'm looking for Jim," the man said in a full, impressive voice. "I see the door's shut, though." He lifted his arm and looked at a wristwatch visible by the silver cufflink. Al gazed at both the watch and the cufflink, and a deep, perplexing yearning came up inside him. That was something he had always wanted, a good wristwatch, the kind he had seen advertised in the New Yorker. Al said,
"He's probably picking up a part, or maybe somebody broke down on the road. They call into him instead of the AAA.
"I can see why," the man said. "If I had even three good cars," Al thought, "I could attract customers like this. If I had anything decent to show." He felt gloomy, and he put his hands into his pockets, rocking back and forth on his heels and staring down at the pavement. He could think of nothing to say. "I've been coming to him for 4.5 years, the man said, "for any little thing I need, even grease jobs." Al said,
"He sold the garage."
The man's eyes widened. With dismay, he said, "No."
"That's right," Al said.
His gloom increased. He found it almost impossible to speak, so he continued rocking back and forth. "Too old?" the man said.
"Heart or something,"
Al murmured. "Well, I certainly am sorry," the man said. "Really sorry. It's the end of an era, the end of the old craftsmanship." Al nodded. "I haven't been in for a month or so," the man said. "When did he decide?" "He must have just decided."
"Yes,"
Al said. The man put out his hand. Al noticed it started, and drew his own hand out and shook. "My name is Harmon," the man said. "Chris Harmon. I'm in the record business. I run Teach Records."
"I see,"
Al said. "You don't think he'll be back," Harmon said, again looking at his watch. "Well, I can't wait. Tell him I was by. I'll call him on the phone and tell him how sorry I am. Good day." Nodding and giving a friendly wave to Al, he got back into his Cadillac, shut the door, shifted into reverse, and in a moment had backed from the lot and out into the San Pablo traffic. Presently the Cadillac had disappeared from sight. Half an hour later, the old man's Pontiac appeared and parked. As Ferguson got out, Al walked up to him.
"An old customer of yours came by," he said. "He was sorry to hear you sold the garage."
"Who?" Ferguson said as he unlocked the garage door and pushed it up with both hands. With a worried expression, he started into the garage.
"God damn," he said. "I'm really behind now with that job, having to go out like that." "Harmon,"
Al said, following along after him. The old man said, "Yes, 58 Cadillac. Good-looking guy, silver hair, around 50.
Owns a record line or something," Al said.
The old man switched on a trouble lamp and dragged the long rubber cord across the grease-covered floor of the garage toward a Studebaker which was up on the hoist.
"You know that brick building up on 23rd, just off Broadway, up where those new car agencies are, near where you branch off to get to the lake? Anyhow, his place is up there. He owns the whole building. It's all his record company. He makes records. A presser."
"So he said," Al said.
He waited for a time, watching the old man lie down on his back on the flat cart with its casters. Ferguson rolled skillfully beneath the Studebaker and resumed work.
"Listen," the old man said from beneath the car.
Al bent down.
"He makes dirty records," the old man said.
At that, Al felt his scalp crawl.
"That well-dressed guy? With that car?"
He could hardly believe it. In his mind, he would have pictured it completely the other way. A man who made dirty records. It would be a short, greasy, sloppily dressed man with perhaps green-tinted glasses, a furtive look, bad teeth, a hoarse voice, picking his teeth with a toothpick.
No kidding.
"That's only one thing he makes," the old man said. "That's just between you and me. It's not public."
"Okay,"
Al said, interested. "It's not his name on it. Teach Records. It's one of those party labels. I mean, no label at all."
"How do you know?"
"He came by about a year ago. He's been coming to me to get his car fixed for years. He brought a box of dirty records, and he wanted me to sell them."
Al laughed.
"No kidding."
The old man wheeled himself out for a moment, lying on his back and looking up at Al. "I kept the box around for a while, but it didn't do anything. There were some folders."
He got laboriously to his feet.
"I think I got a couple left. Sort of dirty joke folders advertising the records."
"I'd like to see them,"
Al said. He followed the old man into the office, where he stood as the old man rummaged in the overflowing desk drawers. At last, in an envelope, the old man came on to what he wanted.
"Here."
He passed the envelope to Al. Opening the envelope, Al found some glossily printed small folders, the size to be put out in a little heap on a counter. A drawing on the front of a nude girl with the words, "Spree Records Summer Fun Fest List for Men Only," and then inside a list of titles. The titles themselves had nothing dirty about them. "Songs," he said, "like Ruth Wallace?"
"Mostly monologues," the old man said. "I listened to one. It was about Eva crossing the ice. You know, in Uncle Tom's Cabin."
"Was it dirty?"
"Really dirty," the old man said. "Every word I ever heard. Some guy was reading it. Harmon said it was some great comedian who writes a lot, or wrote a lot. He said the guy was dead, I think, for all the major magazines. Some really famous guy. You would have recognized the name. Bob something."
"You don't remember it?"
"No."
"I'll be darned," Al said.
"I never met a guy who makes dirty records before. It's illegal, isn't it? Records like that?"
"Well, sure," the old man said. "He makes a lot of other stuff, too, but that's all I saw, just that one thing. I think he puts out some jazz and some classical stuff, specialty stuff, several lines."
Turning to the back of the folder, Al saw that there was no address, no manufacturer.
"I thought he was a banker," he said, "or a lawyer, or a businessman."
"He is a businessman."
That was so. Al nodded.
"He makes a lot of money," the old man said. "You saw his car."
"Plenty of people drive cabs," Al said, "who don't have a bean."
"You should see his house. I have. I let him up there one day. He's got a place up in Piedmont. Practically a mansion. with trees and hedges all around it, and a wrought iron gate, ivy growing up the side of the house, and a really classy-looking wife. He's got at least one other car, too, a Mercedes-Benz sports car.
Maybe not paid for, Al said. He could have almost no equity in the house. I will admit he knows how to dress.
And yet he's been here, the old man said, and stood around and talked to me, and not acted snotty, not acted like he had on a nice suit like that and was in a garage.
Some guys have that, Al said. A real gentleman has that. Grace. It's part of being a real aristocrat.
But he thought, not the kind of profession he had ever identified with the aristocracy.
I hope we're talking about the same guy, he said.
Ask him when you see him again, the old man said. He'll probably be back if he needs some work done in his car. Ask him if he doesn't sell party records.
Maybe I will, Al said.
He'll tell you to your face, the old man said. He's not ashamed. It's a business, like any other.
Hardly that, Al said. Hardly like any other, considering it's illegal. You could probably put the guy in jail with what you know. You better not tell anybody. I hope you aren't telling everybody you see. Didn't he say to keep it quiet?
His face flushing, Ferguson said, I never told anybody but you. Now I wish I hadn't told you. Get off my back. So saying, he wheeled himself onto the Studebaker once more and resumed work.
No offense, Al said.
He wandered back out of the garage again, into the bright sunlight.
I could blackmail him, he thought. The idea bolted through his mind for an instant, sweeping everything away, leaving him trembling. Obviously, Harmon no longer made dirty records. This was a thing out of his past. Probably in those days he had not been wealthy, well-dressed, fashionable. Maybe he had just been starting out. He had not yet arrived. This was a period in his life that he hoped to conceal forever. Thinking that, he felt himself become cold, and then even colder. He felt his heart cease beating for a moment. That really made the blackmail business into something plausible.
Tell me to my face, hell, he thought. If Harmon knew I knew, he'd probably turn black and fall down in a faint.
It was a wholly new idea for making money, the blackmail idea. What had Mrs. Lane said to him? Some damn thing about you got to act or you miss out? Maybe, he thought, she's a prophetess. What's it called? A medium looking into the future.
A fortune teller. This was the ideal business opportunity. It took no capital, no stock, no fixtures, no investment of any kind, not even ads or business cards, nor a state tax franchise. But blackmail was wrong, and yet so was the used car business. Everybody knew that. Nothing was lower than selling used cars, and he had been doing it now for a number of years. Was blackmailing a dirty record manufacturer worse than selling used cars? It was hard to tell.
While he sat at his desk in the little house in the center of his lot, he saw an old brown Cadillac draw up to the curb. A large colored woman stepped out, wearing a cloth coat. She walked toward him, smiling, and he recognized her as Mrs. Lane. Rising, he went outside to meet her.
How do you do, Mr. Miller? She said in a pleasant and yet somehow slightly mocking voice. How are you? Seems to me I just saw you not an hour ago, and here I am to visit.
Her smile broadened.
Come on in,
he said, holding open the door of his office.
Thank you,
she entered, stood while he arranged a chair for her.
Thank you,
she repeated and sat down, crossed her legs, and smoothed her skirt.
Mr. Miller,
she said, when he had also seated himself. You was in talking to me about a lot for your used car sales business?
Frowning, deep in thought, she said, I have called several persons, and I have come up with several locations, one of which I think has special importance, probably to you. It would be ideal for a used car sales lot, although it has never been used that way before.
Her voice, soft, slurred, came over him like a cloud. He sat listening, letting it happen to him. Outdoors, a passerby stopped to examine one of his cars, but Al made no move. He did not stir from his chair.
"This lot," Mrs. Lane said, "is in downtown Oakland, around 10th Street, in the real business district where you don't see so many lots. I mean, it isn't on no used car lot row."
"I see," he said,
and then drawing himself up in his chair, he said,
"I'll tell you, I've been considering another line of business entirely. A new business opportunity that came my way since I talked to you."
Glancing up at him doubtfully, she said,
"You mean since you saw me an hour ago, when you was in my office?"
"Yes,"
he said. She eyed him for a time.
"My goodness," she said.
"It's an entirely different line," he said. "I was sitting here giving it some thought."
"You haven't decided," she said, "for sure."
"No,"
he admitted.
She said, "Mr. Miller, of course I don't have no idea in the world what line it is you're talking about. I know you could go into it, however, and do a bang-up job. I know that. However, I do point out to you that used car sales is what you have been doing for some time. And in my opinion, there's no doubt but what that you chosen profession."
Her voice trailed off. She did not seem certain now. She seemed to be trying to probe him, to draw him out. The notion of the new business opportunity had clearly thrown her off. She went on,
"I like to drive you to the location in question, if you would be willing to permit me. For me, that's an offer always good. I always be willing to do that."
"I know," he said. "Thanks."
With what seemed almost anxiety, she gazed at him and said,
"And no obligation to you, that for sure, Mr. Miller."
She opened her purse and fished around in it.
"I want to get you the very right thing. So many people, they go wrong at this point in relocating. It's such a big thing. They don't know how to do it, and they get worried. They get apprehensive."
She trailed the word out.
"I guess they jump at the first thing,"
he heard himself say. But it was a perfunctory remark. He did not really care about this now. He was still thinking about Harmon. Mrs. Lane said,
"Your whole life depend on a decision of this kind. I tell my clients that. They don't see that, even though it they who are going to be affected for years to come. I know more about them in that regard. I see it all in the almost 14 years I've been a licensed real estate broker in the state of California. There are people right now who buy a particular piece of property through me, thinking of it as a way of making money or an investment. And it changed their lives. They're not the same now. I could give you one, for instance, after another. But I know you are a highly intelligent man, Mr. Miller, and I don't have to go into the particularities. Look how you get to know Mr. Ferguson, and it make you a different person because of."
Her voice had a low, earnest quality. Not like a sales voice at all. He was back once more, as he had been in her office, listening to the mother lecture, or whatever it was that she did. Whatever it was, it had had no relationship to the conventional business interchange, at least as he knew it among whites.
"I think you're right," he managed to say, feeling sleepy, almost unable to keep his eyes open.
Mrs. Lane shut her purse and held it upright on her lap with both her large, oddly light hands.
"What fine hands she has," Al Miller noticed.
"Almost like a man's. Completely competent, as if all the possible muscles and tendons had been used for every skill there was. As if the hands had been everywhere, done everything. And how wrinkled they were. The rest of her was smooth. She had the flesh, the skin of a young girl. Now she had taken off her coat. Again he paid attention to her bare arms. She did not even seem to perspire. Amazing, he thought. And back to her hands. In texture, in color, in size, They bore no relation to the rest of her. Hands joined onto her, he decided. The palms had an almost pinkish quality. The skin there, he thought, was quite thick, almost like leather, and very dry. Studying him with her large, smoky eyes, she said, "I see someone I know drop by here."
"You may have had the experience from your office like I have from mine. You can see up and down the street, and when nobody visiting, you keep looking out for curiosity. Don't it was Mr. Harmon who come by in his coupe de ville not so long ago after you talked to me?"
At that he nodded.
"I know him," Mrs. Lane said. "Let me ask you."
In a halting, preoccupied voice, she said,
"Is it he you going into a business opportunity with?"
Al Miller made a sound that was neither yes nor no. He woke up now. So Mrs. Lane knew Harmon. It made him aware and interested, and also cautious.
"I decipher from your tone," she said, "that you've been in a negotiation with Mr. Harmon, and you had reference to that when you say a new business possibility came your way since you saw me in my office. Well, I want to tell you something."
She looked now, it seemed to him, actually a little frightened. She wet her lips, hesitated, gripped her purse with both hands, and shifted about on the chair.
"This a little chair," she said.
"Yes," he agreed.
"I know him," she said, "something like 5 year. Naturally, I hear a lot of things. That my business. He come up in my business, the real estate business, all the time. He buying and selling, like they say. He get in on things. What they call an operator."
"I see," Al said.
"He got quite a lot of..."
She paused. Then, with a sudden broad smile, showing her ornamented gold front teeth, she continued,
"Well, he ain't like you, Mr. Miller. I mean, he ain't worried he doing the world wrong."
Al nodded. The woman's mellow tone had altered. A flatness, a surprising harshness had come into it. She really did not like Harmon, he realized. Her feelings had come out because she was not a hypocrite. It was not possible for her to pretend to like someone she did not like.
"You think," he said, "I ought to steer clear of Harmon."
Her smile had become softer now, more pensive.
"Well," she said slowly, "that your business, of course. Maybe you know him better than I do."
"No," he said.
"I think you an honest man and he not."
She regarded him with calmness, and yet behind the calmness was agitation. So difficult, he thought, for a Negro, to sit here with a white man and discuss in unflattering terms another white man. At any moment the boom can fall on her. I can cut her off, dismiss her. But it was not precisely that she feared. It was more that she feared he would cease to pay attention to her, that he would freeze up inside his white man's prejudice and ignore what she said.
"I know you have my interest at heart," he said, but although it was deeply meant, it had a phony ring,
a phrase merely. She nodded her head up and down.
"I'll watch my step," he said.